Hello, I'm Rob Gillett, and this is Show This Thread, the podcast that goes beyond the character limit with the best people on Twitter. This is the last in the current series, but I'll be back in September with more great guests. With that in mind, it's more important than ever that you subscribe so you don't miss them. You can also follow Show Thread Pod on Twitter for news and updates. On this episode, I'm joined by Justin Myers, a writer and columnist for titles including GQ and the Sunday Times Style. His debut novel, The Last Romeo, was published last year. Justin is also known as The Guyliner, a pseudonym he'd previously used when writing an anonymous dating blog. That blog lives on, only now analysing other people's dating exploits who feature in The Guardian's Blind Dates column. Justin is a big Twitter user, posting more than 106,000 times so far, which is where our discussion begins.
I haven't deleted anything from, you know, a lot of people I think kind of delete as they go on, or some people go back and delete a chunk, and I've never done that.
I've done that.
Why?
I don't really know. I felt like I'd kind of gone down not dark routes, but Ooh. Like I'd sort of, I don't know, I had a lot of questions about whether I was being authentically myself on Twitter. Mm. And I still do. But that was the result of a particularly kind of questioning time of, like, do I want this to be a permanent record? Because I don't really believe it reflects who I am. It's quite deep, isn't it, for the first 5 minutes?
It's quite deep. I know what you mean, and I have thought about it occasionally, but especially because some of my early tweets were so cringe and desperate for attention, I suppose. But I find them quite interesting. Sometimes if I want to tweet about something that I have a feeling I've said before, I'll go back and do a quick search. The main issue with my old tweets is that they're boring. But I'm quite happy to be for that to go on a permanent record that I am relatively boring.
You've grown as a tweeter.
I'm not sure about that. I suppose rather than growing, which suggests a kind of a permanent state, I'm more like an old lung that kind of inflates and deflates. So I have good moments, inflated, I assume, and then all the air comes out.
I think that's one of the hardest things about social media in general. And like, I find this, not just doing it for myself, but doing it professionally, if that's such a thing, is you sort of start every day on zero. And, you know, obviously, not to become obsessed with the numbers, but when you do it for a brand, that's sort of the only measure of success you have.
Yeah.
And you can do something one day that works really well, and you can think the thing that you're doing the next day is going to work really well as well, and it doesn't.
No.
So yeah, that lung analogy very much describes my work life. So as a sort of intro to you, the Guyliner as a pseudonym,
yes.
How did that come about?
In 2010, I started my blog, which I called Guyliner, and it was. The post is still there, but it was an anonymous dating blog, whereupon I would go on dates with men and write about them anonymously, keeping everyone anonymous. And I called it Guyliner for no reason other than I liked the word. And then I retconned a meaning into it, in that I was lining up guys. I mean, that's complete bullshit, but that's what I pretended it was for. Like, when people asked me later,
okay.
That's what I said. And then I couldn't get at Guyliner on Twitter. It's gone through various owners, none of whom have done very much with it, apart from tweet the odd thing. I think it was a band's Twitter when I first got it. So I just put the in front of it, and that's how I became the Guyliner. And then as I got more work as the Guyliner, that became my name. So completely weirdly and randomly.
How long ago was it that you lifted the mask off and kind of revealed your real identity?
It was January 2017. So I was anonymous for nearly 7 years.
Wow. Was it difficult to keep up, or surprisingly easy?
Difficult. It became very boring because I was not particularly adept at hiding my identity. The only thing I hid was my face and my name, but I said where I was going and what I was doing, and, you know, there were lots of identifying features. You know, if you really cared enough, you could probably find out who I was quite quickly. And a few people did, and Most people just absorbed the information and didn't do anything with it.
Okay.
Some people tried to maybe abuse it a little. And it was basically causing me more annoyance and irritation than being open would have done. But I decided that the only reason I would unmask myself was, you know, it had to be worth it. It had to be for a good reason, not just for the sake of, oh, and this is me. Because what I have noticed over the years of seeing a lot of anonymous Twitter accounts become unmasked is that no one cares. No one really cares.
Right.
And you can only disappoint them if you're like, oh, this is a big thing and I'm going to unmask myself. I look at the example of Belle de Jour, who was not huge on Twitter when she unmasked herself, but, you know, that was in an anonymous blog, similar kind of thing to mine, obviously. She was extremely famous and had a book published and everything. No one cared, and lots of people made unkind comments because she was not what they were expecting in more ways than one. You know, she was a scientist, I think, and looked not how they expected and didn't do the job she expected. And I think I was very wary of it just being an attention grab rather than for a valid reason. So when I got the book deal and they said, we're not going to publish it under the name The Guyliner, and I said, fine. They asked if I wanted to have a different pseudonym, a nom de plume, as they call it when it's a book, or my real name. And I thought, for my parents, I'll go under my real name. And also, how many aliases does one man need? I was doing my head in, so yeah. I thought, no, let's just do it.
Yeah, it gets confusing, yeah. Sort of turning up at the thing, thinking you're supposed to be one of them, and
yeah, it was getting annoying.
Which brings us nicely on to your book, The Last Romeo.
Yes.
I have been known to describe this as a sort of like a gay Bridget Jones.
Okay.
I don't know if that's a description that you like or don't like. One caveat to that is that I would say it's a modern gay Bridget Jones.
Mm. I'm not going to complain about being compared against a very, very famous and good best-selling novel with a character that is adored by millions around the world. Other people have described it as that, and I get the comparison because it's kind of, I suppose, a diary in form almost. The only reason I would be wary of it being compared to Bridget Jones is that when people read it and find it's not like Bridget Jones, they leave me really annoyed reviews on Amazon.
Well, I'll stop saying that.
No, it's okay, because it's on the Amazon, because I think the BBC reviewed it and said that's what it is. And I guess it is. If you like Bridget Jones, you'll like this, and you might. Yeah, it's similar in that it has a central character who is a little bit deluded and a little bit downtrodden at first, and has some decisions to make. But yeah, modern, I get more of an updated version, I suppose. With Bridget Jones, there are two very clear love interests, aren't there? And she has quite poor self-esteem.
Yeah.
And the self-esteem definitely is they have that in common with The Last Romeo, but there's no... Oh, actually, remembering the plot of my own book. No, there are a couple of love interests. Okay. Yeah, modern Bridget Jones. Yeah,
We'll go with it. So just to kind of set it up a bit more, the premise is that your central character, who's called James...
Yes.
Finds himself single, comes out of a long-term relationship, yes. And starts to go dating.
Yes.
And... also starts a blog.
Yes.
About these, this sounds familiar.
This was such a stretch. I had to really do so much research. Yes, the premise is similar. The main differences is that the relationship that James comes out of is quite a miserable one, where he is kind of gaslit. Do you say gaslit or gaslighted?
Gaslit.
He's a victim of gaslighting. And his boyfriend kind of breaks his confidence. That was not the case for me. It was an amicable breakup with my partner. But the starting the blog and going on dates anonymously, yes. And then, but the twist is that the difference where it veers off into fiction and fantasy is James, who blogs under the pseudonym of Romeo, goes on a date with an Olympian who is closeted and blogs about him and finds himself going viral. Which never really happened to me. I did not have sex with a closeted Olympian, to the best of my knowledge.
Did you have a point though with just switching between the two things, which I hope doesn't get confusing? But when you were writing as the guyliner about your dates, was there a particular post that made it take off?
There was a change when I did a collaboration with another anonymous blogger, and we met each other and we wrote about each other, and that took off. That was quite huge. Oh yeah, I think it was the one in the bath. Yes. So I wrote about a date where I invited a man to come round and have a bath with me. This is very out of character, by the way. This sounds, I don't even know what that makes me sound like.
Well, but I just wondered if you had a series of like scenarios and you would pick them out of a hat and then go, right.
No, I was hungover and running a bath, and was talking to a man online, and I said, come round for a bath. And he didn't. He said, oh, you must be joking. But I said, well, if you ever fancy a bath, let me know. And then we were talking again another time, and he asked if we could meet, and I said, yes, I'll run the bath. And I did. I did exactly that. And he came round, and we had a bath together. That one is in the book, but very highly fictionalised.
Right, okay.
Well, most of the book is highly fictionalised. It's funny, my boyfriend, who I didn't know then, obviously, said to me, oh, I used to think that blog about you getting the bath with the guy was really hot. And then I saw the bathroom it happened in. In my defense, I thought that bathroom was quite a nice bathroom, but my boyfriend did not agree.
Back then to The Last Romeo, just to sort of fully flesh it out, not give away, obviously, too much of it, because we hope people go and read it.
Yes.
The other part of James's world in that book that I particularly found entertaining was that he is this kind of showbiz journalist who moves sort of, is sort of a bit disenchanted with that
yeah,
world.
Yeah, it's a very, I mean, you know, oh, another book about a journalist who's disillusioned with journalism, lol. But no, it's not really like that. It's that he's in the kind of production line of journalism where he works for a website who... It's a website that publishes quite demeaning pieces about celebrities, mainly based on photos and zooming in. I'm sure you can imagine where the inspiration for this fictional website
Couldn't
came
possibly.
From, called Snap. So he thinks that he is capable of more and deserves better. And that's why he starts the blog, because he thinks he's a great writer and that he shouldn't be lowering himself to be doing this kind of thing. And he starts the blog. Now, I'm making James sound like quite a conceited character, and he is. I think he is, and as time goes on, he gradually begins to be stripped of those conceits. But yes, he definitely thinks that he is above what he's doing.
There's sort of, I found the book, I mean, quite relatable in some respects, being a similar age. And particularly to do with not so much to do with the relationship side, because I am in a long-term relationship, but I was in one when I read it. So yeah. I've never really been in that position. But in terms of the work stuff, and there's like these sort of young upstarts who are sort of constantly agitating him around
yes.
the way that they sort of approach their work and see the world. And he becomes quite frustrated at their kind of, they're just sort of a bit lazy, but
yeah.
then it still kind of works out for them.
I mean, that is not my real life experience, but it's something that I see a lot. I'm fascinated by this continuous battle between the generations that seem to be happening purely because we feel we should be having them. And yes, James is 34 when the book opens and is quite insecure about his place in the world. He, as well as thinking that he is better than the job he's doing, he thinks he should be doing a better job because he is older. So he sees his peers at work who are a decade his junior getting, you know, the same amount of career progression as he is, none, but yet acing it by doing quite little work. It's always I'm fascinated by one of his kind of office nemeses, Hurley, is not only a journalist on the website, but he's also a burgeoning YouTube sensation. And James is furious at this because he thinks it looks so easy, and really he wishes he'd thought of it first.
Yeah, yeah.
And he thinks that this Hurley is getting this glory and fame for kind of no reason, completely oblivious to the fact that, you know, maintaining an online audience is quite hard work and that, you know, you have to put a lot of yourself into it. So he's, yeah, I was very much inspired by a lot of the generational battles I see happening in the media and online, which is everyone thinks that everyone else is better off than them for reasons none of them really want to go into.
And drawing kind of really arbitrary lines of like the idea that once you pass from this age to this age, you become this. Like, it's just nonsense.
And, to be fair to James, it works both ways as well. So the younger guy who works in his office just can't believe that someone as old as James is doing that job when he thinks he's so much better than it. Then why aren't you somewhere else doing some better job? So it's kind of that constant battle between them. But yeah, I especially being, you know, a gay man, I notice a lot of insecurity around age. And I really wanted to bring that to the book and also to show how kind of trivial and nonsensical it is and what a waste of time it is to be so hung up on it, because you can't possibly... There's so many other factors affecting our lives that to be ruled by an arbitrary number is such a silly waste of time.
What has the response to the book been like from gay men who are sort of around James's age? Because I felt like when I read it that there wasn't that much out there that really captured that experience in the nicest possible way, on quite a normal level.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of like stuff about kind of glitzy, glamorous LA types, or
yes,
sort of people living a hedonistic lifestyle in Berlin. Like, yeah. But I had never really read anything that was like, oh yeah, that's quite similar to what I do day to day.
Yeah, the day to day thing was important to me because I feel the same. I felt there wasn't, I'm sure they exist, but I felt there wasn't really much out there just showing what it was like for a gay man. I mean, even his job is, you know, some people think that would consider that to be a glamorous job, but James doesn't. And I did kind of waver over whether to give him a different job, but his job actually becomes very important to the plot. The reaction has been largely positive. The reaction has been more positive than I was expecting, because I think books that have an LGBT character at their heart come under much greater scrutiny from the LGBT audience. We are very mindful of how our stories are told. We're very and there's a reason we're like this. It's because experience has shown us that our stories are going to be told very badly, usually by straight people or by people trying to show the extremes. So like you say, the, you know, the hedonistic lifestyles in Berlin. Not that I'm anything against that. I'd quite like to have a hedonistic lifestyle in Berlin, or the super glamorous LA stuff. So we're wary. We're very guarded about how our stories are told. You know, it's, and so we're very vocal about criticizing them if we feel underrepresented or misrepresented in these stories. So I was expecting, if I'm honest, a bigger backlash, just because I expected people to be looking at it more closely. So I was very pleased when, on the whole, it got a positive reaction from everybody, really. Not much negative feedback has come my way. Either I haven't seen it or it doesn't exist, I'm not sure. There's been the odd bit, but even the negative feedback, I kind of understand where they're coming from and agree, because this is not supposed to be a perfect, definitive representation of what it's like to be a gay man in the 2010s. So it's been positive, a nice surprise.
I'm
a lot
glad.
Of gay men have said to my, in a way, a horror, that they can see a lot of themselves in James. I think for a lot of the book, he's a nightmare.
Well,
that's to be discovered by anyone who hasn't read it yet.
The next thing I want to talk to you about, which will lead into Twitter, is your blogs about the Guardian
blind dates
column, which has become something of a sensation.
I love the word sensation.
Particularly this year, there was the one that went viral.
Oh, the two
lesbian
women, Joanne and Morgan.
Girls who met and had just the best time. Can't remember, but the headline to that was something quite sensational.
I left my knickers at a party that we gate crashed. That's paraphrase, right. It was something along those lines.
You then take that column and kind of deconstruct it.
This is always a very difficult thing to explain. even for people who read the Guardian blind date column, because nobody can quite understand why I do it, myself included. So for the uninitiated, in Guardian Weekend magazine every Saturday, there is a column called Blind Date, where they send two people they've never met before out for a free meal. And the people then report back via email and or phone to someone at the Guardian, the lovely Nina, hi Nina, who compiles the column and goes in. And it's really popular. The column itself is very, very popular. It's not that they usually end up being quite dramatic, but there's always misread signals. One of them always likes the other less than is reciprocated. It's quite an interesting study, really, about what people are willing to say about what happens to them in a national magazine if they're not trained, you know, media professionals.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've been a fan of this column for as long as I can remember, and almost 5 years ago, I decided that this column needed deeper analysis for reasons I can't remember, and so I started a blog about it. I already had my anonymous dating blog, but I wasn't blogging about dates anymore, really, because I've met someone and I didn't want to shut it down. Mm-hmm. I felt a fondness for it and I was still anonymous. So I started reviewing the blind dates, which means I basically go through everything. This sounds really evil. I go through everything they've said and analyze it. But usually what I'm doing when I'm analyzing it, I'm not really analyzing the people saying it. I'm taking what they say and going off in a different direction with it, either my own anecdotes or observations about modern life in general, or going back into the past, or comments on current culture, that kind of thing.
I mean, it works really well, because I think ultimately the date, first date or blind date scenario is quite an awkward situation anyway.
Yeah.
So then you take that to the next level of people talking about that and themselves within that context.
Yeah.
They come out with things that you kind of go, what? Or where's that come from?
Exactly.
Which then when you then break that down becomes really funny.
Because the beauty of the blind date column in its original form in the Weekend magazine is that it's very short, they're restricted to one or two line answers, and the format is quite rigid. They're asked the same questions every week. So, you know, there was a guy who contacted me a few months ago to say that he'd done a statistical analysis of how often people said certain things in answer to the questions, and it was really interesting. It's called Impeccable Table Manners, simply because there is a question within the column which asks, what are their table manners like? And loads of people kept saying impeccable. When do you ever hear that word anywhere else?
I mean,
what else would their table manners be like, unless they got on the table and took their shirt off or shoved a chopstick goodness knows where?
But how do you even quantify
table manners? What's the scale? You know, I need to see the metrics. So impeccable crops up quite a lot. So yeah, I do this. It started out, I did it every Saturday morning for a long time. And then, because I write 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And I have a certain amount of energy per day for writing. And so if I have something I really need to get done, I don't do them. So they came back recently, but I had a couple of months off where I was finishing my second novel. So when time allows, I do them. But when I don't do them, I get all sorts of haranguing in my email and
where is it?
Yeah, it's kind of like...
Yeah, I can imagine. But I mean, I think that's just a good sign that people love it.
So I take it in the spirit it's meant.
And I'd imagine, bringing us nicely onto the main topic of this podcast, supposedly, a lot of that haranguing comes through the medium of Twitter.
I mean, I've been a journalist for a long time, but I owe kind of this phase of my career, if you can call it that, entirely to Twitter. I think that's how I built my audience on the Guyliner. I became what people call a presence. I don't like being called, what is it someone said, you know, a Twitter celebrity or something, or a, what's the other one? Part of the Twitterati. I'm not really into that.
I don't know what
just
Twitterati
on Twitter.
Is.
I don't. Who's
really
in it? I don't know.
I don't, maybe you are in it. Maybe you just don't know.
I'm going to need to see the list
the
of
full
who else
lineup.
Is on it before I take that as a compliment. So, but without Twitter, I don't think I would have the book deal. It's all about reach, isn't it? And people started to hear about my work because of Twitter. I don't know how I would have got that audience without it.
I think you're right in that it is about reach, but I think beyond that, it's about making the right connections to make that happen.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know.
So
that there's
I don't equate reach with numbers.
Yeah,
at all.
I don't think there's anywhere else that that can happen as easily.
Yeah, for an instant, you know, reaction to what people think of you and to see your reach, well, reaching. Twitter is great for that. It really is immediate. And that's what I've been in, you know, I've written for online for nearly two decades, and that the immediacy of writing online has always been what's appealed to me. Being an author now does my head in because it takes so long. So Twitter's my preferred medium because of its speediness and immediacy.
And in terms of your kind of relationship with Twitter, if you like, like how much time are you spending on it in a day, and where does that occur? Do you take little breaks from writing and get straight onto Twitter, or are you quite routined with it, or is it very random?
I'm not spending as much time on Twitter as I used to. I've been back on it a little bit recently. I deleted it off my phone at the end of last year.
Oh, really?
Not because I wanted to do a big flounce off Twitter, but I found what I was doing was I was just looking at it when there was any moment of downtime when I was not being stimulated in some other way. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice if Twitter became just like a sometimes treat, you know, something I dip in and out of rather than like just automatically going to. And I thought I would probably have more fun on it and find it more interesting if I did that. And I was kind of right. So I look at it, but yeah, if I'm at my desk, I do look at it every now and again. It's always good if I get, you know, stuck on a sentence. I have a kind of a list of things I do if I'm, you know, some go-to things I do if I'm stuck on a sentence or whatever. You know, make tea, empty the dishwasher, if I'm working from home.
Really helpful in the office.
Or if I'm somewhere else and working, then yeah, I will look at Twitter, have a quick look. But I don't have a rigid, set time to be on it, or not now that I don't really, you know, before when I've worked for clients doing their social media for them, then yes, I would, but not now. It's all for me.
I find it really interesting that you don't have it on your phone. I don't know why I would assume this, but just from following you and seeing how often you tweet and how much you reply, like I just felt like you would be someone who was very much a phone-based user.
Yeah, this is another reason actually that I took it off my phone, is because I... when you post on Twitter and you have the number of followers I have, and I'm not saying that in a boastful way. I have, I think, over 23,000 followers now, and that's a lot. For me, that's a lot. I know it's not a lot compared with, you know, famous people, but that's quite a lot to get your head around. And so when you tweet something, someone is always going to reply.
Yeah.
Even if you get, like, you know, three replies, someone is always replying. And I've always felt a great responsibility not to ignore anyone, because I have seen for myself how, you know, cutting it can be when someone doesn't reply. I see it happen on my Twitter feed, you know, someone trying to get involved. Because Twitter, for me, is not about broadcasting. It's about conversation. But when you have a certain number of followers and when you do a certain job and you're promoting your work, you naturally toward more being a broadcaster. But I don't ever want to be just that person who only tweets links to their work. So where I'm going with this is, when I had it on my phone and I would tweet something, I would be checking to see if anyone replied, not because it validated me in any way, although it is nice when someone replies to you, but because I didn't want to leave anyone hanging. But I have always said before on Twitter that if I don't reply to, I read everything, I read all the replies. So if I haven't been on Twitter all day, I will go and read every reply that, you know, at the end of the day, I'll go on to my desktop and read all the replies. But I don't reply to anyone unless there is something new to say. Because I have another thing where I don't like tweets either.
Oh, really?
I have never liked a tweet.
Why is that?
I don't like it, funnily enough, I don't like it as a function. I don't like the like function at all. I don't like that it can be interpreted in so many ways. I don't like that it can be used negatively. I think if you want to shade somebody, then reply and, you know, do it in your reply. Not, you know, the shady likes I don't like. I also don't like the fact that Twitter lists them on your profile.
Yes.
So someone can see what you've liked, yeah, and get a picture of you, which may not be an accurate picture of who you are. My Twitter feed about me is representing myself as honestly as I can. Obviously, there's a degree of, you know, because I wrote as a persona for so long, there's going to be a degree of separation from my normal self and the Twitter self or whatever. But it has to portray me as honestly as possible. And because you can never know why someone has liked something, or, you know, you just can't tell. So I don't like anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt a responsibility to reply to people to make sure that they didn't feel ignored. And that's completely impossible to sustain for any long period.
Yeah, yeah. And
so
kind
of
tying those two points together, there is the kind of use of the like to signal, I'm done with this conversation.
This conversation is over,
I'm out.
Yeah.
Interesting point. I do use the like button, and hopefully I do use it quite genuinely, but maybe I do use it when I feel as though I should like something because there's a personal or professional connection, and that it would be weird if someone knew that I had seen their thing and I hadn't. Anyway, it's all of this that contributes to, like, I get quite a kind of anxious, into quite an anxious state around social media sometimes, which is messed up thing to go through when it's your job. But I increasingly feel more sensitive to all of those sorts of things about what does me doing that mean? If I write this, is it actually going to offend this one person, even though it might entertain or...
Exactly. I am a great catastrophizer. So I think if I liked stuff, I would be too worried about how that like would be taken, how it would be interpreted. So as a rule, I don't. And yeah, I can't reply to it. So I get that, like, I agree with you. I get that kind of anxiety around things as well. So it's easier for me to remove the things that are the simplest things, you know, to remove from that. So what can I do about that? I can take it off my phone. Also with the added bonus that I don't spend as long on it. And also I'm doing other things. So I'll read on my phone, or I'll play, I like word games. And just something that, because the thing about Twitter as well for me is that it's, as well as I enjoy being on Twitter a lot, but it's also a professional thing for me. You know, so I promote my work on it. And so I suppose if I'm not on Twitter all the time on my phone, I feel less like I'm at work.
Yes, yeah, I can relate to that.
So, yeah, absolutely, you can relate to that. So, because of what you do. So that's why I took it off my phone. I've no regrets.
Apart from the like button, what's the one thing that you've got no time for in your Twitter feed?
Didn't happen. Are you aware of Didn't Happen?
I'm not.
Didn't Happen Twitter is a rather large Twitter movement which irritates me, and it is, to talk about it very clinically, it is when people tweet about something they have experienced and you get a flurry of replies, usually something quite not hard to believe, that something that wouldn't happen every day. So whether it's a run-in with a celebrity or an embarrassing moment, that kind of thing, and you get a flurry of replies, usually from... The people who reply always look the same. I won't say what they look like, but you can imagine. Didn't happen, mate. Or, yeah, sounds like it happened. Or they tag in a Twitter account. There are a couple of Twitter accounts that are dedicated solely to retweeting and kind of shaming and mocking, I suppose, the person who has posted the original tweet about this thing that happened to them that other people are saying is a lie. I hate that. If you think someone is lying on Twitter, then just kind of shrug and think whatever, unless it's harmful. So if it's something that's harmful or, you know, has the potential to get lots of attention for the wrong reasons, then, yeah, call it out.
There's a difference,
there's
though,
a difference,
between this interesting, notable thing happened and here's some misinformation.
Yeah,
like, that's
exactly.
That's,
but if it's just someone making up something that makes them look good and they're not really getting any revenue or, you know, attention or credit for it, then just ignore it. Twitter is full of liars and people who talk nonsense and bullshitters and irritating people and full of them. Why add to that noise of being annoying by saying it didn't happen? Because you in yourself are trying to... What it's really saying is you are envious that this person is getting traction from something they've tweeted and you want some of those numbers for yourself. I hate numbers Twitter as well. People who comment... People who get lots of retweets and likes, fair enough, congratulations. But then people who say, oh, pure numbers underneath. I can't stand it. I can't stand it.
The sort of recognition of it. Yeah,
oh, it's cringe. I hate it. I hate it.
This
so
has
much.
Just reminded me of something that I think you tweeted earlier. So
oh God.
I nearly just brought up something to put to you that I read on your feed, which was a link to an article about these flop accounts, which sound entirely different to what they are.
Oh God.
Are. A horrible thing where people are tweeting quite sincerely about serious issues and then these little shits are creating full-on accounts where they just
There are a lot of these. Yeah, they're more of an Instagram thing, but they do exist on Twitter as well. So the didn't happen one I mentioned is one of them, I suppose. Basically, they're exposing and, you know, inviting, mockery onto people. So, you know, there are ones... Some of them are quite funny. I think it's all about punching up and punching down, isn't it? And there are some, like there's an account called DJs Complaining, I think.
Okay.
Which is very, very rich, world-famous DJs moaning about something really trivial.
Okay, well, that's fine.
And like, it's about... So if it's punching up, then I completely get it. But when it's not quite as clear as that, when you're using it to belittle someone, I'm not into it at all. But yeah, the flop accounts thing, for the uninitiated, is very much an Instagram phenomenon at the moment, but it exists to a degree on Twitter. And it's... purely screenshotting and reposting someone's posts and saying horrible things about them.
Pointless waste of time.
Yeah, who's
horrible
got time
people.
For it? That is what private WhatsApp groups are for. We all love a bitch and we all slag people off. To deny otherwise is pointless. But these are public, private conversations that should be happening in a group that you all understand where each other's coming from. Because I think that, you know, most people who do that don't mean anyone any specific... you know, or horrible intent. You know, they don't mean any harm. But the people doing it in public very clearly do.
Broadcasting it to the world is entirely different.
Well, these love
to sharing
attention,
a joke
that's the thing. They can't help themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a quick fire question. It's not a thing I do. Something occurred to me and I keep switching between the two. And actually, you haven't got the app on your phone, so this might not be relevant. But algorithm or latest tweets?
Latest.
Yeah.
It would always be latest.
Yeah,
Instagram
good.
Upsets me.
Correct answer.
Facebook drives me nuts as well. I see things from 3 days ago, 4 days ago, that I could, you know, I could have had a great comment on, but it was very time sensitive. And to jump up on it now would be very late to the party.
Yeah, that's a frustrating scenario. The other one that I have is I don't actually open my personal Instagram account very often. I mean, say not very often. I might open it every 3 days.
Yeah.
And then I will just... Ultimately, I'll get quite bored by, like, fourth or fifth scroll.
Yeah.
And then I miss the thing that I want to see.
Well, what really annoys me about Instagram... I know we're here to talk about Twitter, but...
No, it's fine.
When you go into Instagram, because I do have that on my phone, because you can't really use it on desktop.
No.
You open it... and there's a really interesting image at the top and you're like, ooh, but then it refreshes and
it
disappears
away.
Under 4 fucking days worth of absolute mindless
that's
whatever
really irritating.
From the past week. Oh. Social media is very stressful. It feels like it's designed to make you more stressed sometimes.
Oh, I mean, it contributes to not all of my stress, but a significant percentage.
Yeah.
Okay, so this bit I've done with everyone that I've interviewed so far, and I go onto Google News Search and put in your Twitter handle.
Oh, shit.
And then this brings up, well, for you, it just brings up loads of things that you've written, which is really good. But amongst that are stories where journalists have embedded your tweets as part of the story.
God.
And actually, this first one is just a great story. And your tweet is embedded in it, but the story is actually about you.
What?
Lizzie and Thomas.
Oh, thank God for that. Yes. I wondered what that was going to be. Lizzie and Thomas.
Yeah.
A Guardian blind date couple whose appearance in the column I reviewed, and they got on so well that I predicted Thomas would propose. And he did, eventually. And for some reason, that's news. I think he got into the... Was it the Mirror?
It was. This originally I found on the Daily Edge.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was also in the Mirror. That might be the same company. I don't know.
Might be a Trinity Mirror thing.
But yes, no, I think that's newsworthy.
That's a good one to be in. I'm quite glad about that.
I think it's a lovely
story. For
some
reason, the whole story was that I had predicted they'd get married. When anyone with, you know, more than one brain cell to bugger the other could have read that and thought, ooh, they'll probably get on really well and we'll get married.
Crucially, though, the story is that they invited you to their wedding.
Oh, yes, they have. It's in December. I am going.
Where is it?
I don't think I should say.
Oh. Well, what do you mean? We can't all come.
Yeah, sorry, Lizzie and Thomas, if you're listening, I have not replied or anything, but I am coming. I'm waiting until I get the invitation before I reply.
I'm glad you put that in, because it means I can now tweet them when I put this episode out. maybe I'll get a new story. Is that too far removed?
If I can get a new story from saying that in a really off-the-cuff comment in a blog, anyone can, surely.
The next one, from the Shropshire Star.
Oh, good Lord.
This is... It's not quite what you would think from a local newspaper title. It's actually a story about people getting their A-level results, and they've put together a list of 10 tweets reacting to A-level results day. Yours is the top one.
Oh, no.
And it says that if your boyfriend or girlfriend's got good A-level results and are going off to university, you'll get dumped by Christmas.
Yes, I tweet that every year.
They refer to you as this writer.
This writer?
Yeah.
Ooh. Better than being referred to as... Well, you know, it's true, I am a writer, I can't really sue them for that.
No. I mean, it was just this kind of...
Lack of decoration on that title.
They haven't researched you.
No. Why would they? The Shropshire Star.
Well, they're taking your content. I think it's fair.
Yeah.
To be honest, you haven't got that many results on like the first page of Google News search that you haven't written yourself. So I've discounted all of those for now. Mashable. This is a really shit thing. Pride somewhere basically put out all these posters which were praising straight people.
Oh! I remember that campaign.
Which I'd not seen this story until today when I found this.
What on earth are they doing?
Really horrible, badly thought out campaign.
It was badly thought... It was well-intentioned, but it was... Yes, it was badly thought out, and I was quite vocal about that. Yeah, I had a series of tweets about that, and then I got a commission on the back of that, actually, in The Guardian. So I wrote about it. It was the whole hashtag love is love angle, and... They had a series of posters that I think only appeared online, and there were quotes from mainly straight people saying how okay they all were with the LGBTQ thing, and I thought that was really tin-eared of them to do, because Pride is not about being palatable for straight people or straight people being okay with us. It is about saying to straight people, this is who we are and this is what we're doing. You know, deal with it or whatever.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. It's not, you know, one of the quotes on the posters was, some of my friends think I'm gay and I'm totally fine with it. And honestly, I just wanted to run.
That's the one that really got me.
I wanted to run into a wall really fast because, you know, tone deaf. I really dragged them for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Deservedly.
Bloody
sorry,
good.
London Pride. I'm not involved with them anyway, so it's fine.
And the last one I've got down here, which I did like this story at the time, when Madonna couldn't get her FedEx parcel because FedEx wouldn't believe that she was Madonna.
Oh, yeah. Proof of ID or
and
something.
And you said that you could imagine her at the Royal Mail post office with her, we could not deliver your parcel.
Yes.
Slip of paper.
Imagine being that person in the sorting office when Madonna comes in, raging, top to toe in her usual uniform of Ed Hardy sweatshirt and bizarre trousers, waggling her, sorry you weren't home, slip. You'd give her the parcel, right?
Yeah.
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 What I really want to know about this, actually, is... Was the parcel addressed to, you know, M. Ciccone,
mm-hmm.
because her name is Madonna Ciccone, or was it just addressed to Madonna? I want to know, because on these slips, the sorry you were out slips, the postie has to write the name. so that you can identify yourself. So did they write, their hand must have been shaking, I imagine, as they wrote Madonna.
Yeah. What makes me laugh the most about that, and this happens in quite a few situations, is Madonna feeling so aggrieved about this parcel situation that she felt it appropriate to make that one of her Instagram posts.
You see, Madonna is human after all.
Yeah, well, nothing shows it more than that. Celebrities generally complaining to companies on Twitter or any social media is always entertaining. It never makes them sound good.
It's funny you should mention that, actually, because to go back to things I don't like seeing on Twitter is I generally don't like people who will complain about something on Twitter before approaching the person, the company they have the beef with first. So, you know, having a bad customer service experience and then going straight to Twitter. I'm quite old-fashioned, perhaps, and I believe that you should first try and get it sorted by the company or whatever. And then, I mean, if you're reacting to something that's happened to you, then fine. But I think, you know, atting them and trying to get customer service over Twitter in the first instance is a bit off.
Yeah, I mean, some companies actively push that.
Some
so
encourage
that's okay.
It, yeah.
I think half the time people are doing that, they're trying to get something for free. I'll admit, 100%. I have done it. And this is, you know, to the point of me having deleted tweets from my past. When I was a breakfast radio newsreader and I was having to get up at 4 in the morning every day. Mm. I lived opposite a house full of students who were noisy and annoying, and that's sort of to be expected.
Yeah.
But one night they got a pizza delivery at like 1 a.m. and the driver pulled up in his car and had music, like, you know, someone's got like a sound system in their car that just kind of thumps and like has got like a subwoofer in the boot, parked up and left all the doors open. And was there for like 5 minutes.
And oh,
this
no.
was when I had like one of those nights where I got to bed early and I was just like furious. Woke up and then tweeted the pizza company. And as a result, they actually sent about 20 pizzas to the radio station.
Oh, that's nice.
On the Friday. It was nice. By that time, there was only about 6 people working at the radio station. So we had far too much pizza. Anyway, that's
me. I used to live opposite Nando's. And I once phoned them to complain that their music was too loud.
Did they give you a Nando's black card?
No, they didn't. I didn't at the minute, you see. I tweeted afterwards that I'd just done it and that I was ashamed of myself for turning into my grandfather. Because it was shut and I think they were, you know, cleaning up after. But the music was ear-splitting. And I just phoned them and I said, would you mind turning your music down? And I could almost feel them wondering where the phone call had come from. They did turn it down, but I realised how ridiculous the situation that was, and so I did tweet that after that I'd done that, but it was not in a Nando's are bad, it's in a I am actually a terrible person for doing that. But it was Nando's music as well, which is, you know,
what music do they play in Nando's? I'm trying to think. Is it like
it's Portuguese kind of music, so it's good. But when it's loud and piping out of a speaker kind of a few hundred yards away from you, it's a bit like when someone's talking out loud on their phone, you know, on the bus. It's annoying for reasons you can't explain.
It sounds a bit like when you go on holiday and you hear the local music and you think, that's amazing, I feel so relaxed and on holiday, so I'll buy the CD, and then you play it at home and it's not the same.
You're just not in the same zone at all.
In any way, shape or form.
When you're in Nando's, you don't mind it, but then when you're at your desk trying to work and it's playing and it's tinny because it's coming out of a speaker miles away, then yeah, it's not great.
Okay, last few. Obviously, you're a member of the Twitterati and a Twitter celebrity and all of those things that you hate.
Grim.
You have a Twitter presence. What is your one piece of advice for getting the most out of Twitter?
Don't live on it. Don't live on Twitter. Remember that it really doesn't, unless you are a social media manager, it really doesn't matter if you don't get a lot of retweets or likes or attention. And if you do, it's nice because it means people like what you're saying, but don't be beholden to that and don't assume it will always be that way. And don't let it drive what you say, because if you start saying things to get that attention, you end up not being who you really are. And then you're wandering into really dangerous territory, like those people who tweet things for attention in a bad way. I'm not going to name the people, but think of famous television presenters or former reality TV contestants who are now columnists. Think of those people who get addicted to attention and use it for bad. I think you have to be very realistic about what Twitter actually means and its usefulness in your life. So there's an element here of don't take it too seriously, but obviously if someone is, you know, hounding you and being horrible to you, then you need to take that seriously. I think be honest with yourself about what you can get out of Twitter and do not do things for attention only, because the thing about attention is that you crave it, and yet when you have it, you do not get to control how long it lasts. They do.
Wise words there from Justin Myers. You can follow him on Twitter. He's at The Guyliner. Just remember not to like any of his tweets. His book, The Last Romeo, is out now, and you can read Justin's impeccable table manners blog at theguyliner.com. Thanks to Justin for taking part and for being my final guest on Series 1 of Show This Thread. I hope you've enjoyed it. I've had a great time. I've met some lovely people. I even got to meet Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, last week as a result. Who knows what Series 2 will bring. I'll be back in September with more great guests. For now, though, make sure you subscribe to the podcast and follow Show Thread Pod over on Twitter. That way you won't forget about me. I've been Rob Gillett. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time on Show This Thread.